We have been given the impression that if we just turn things over to God, they're going to get better. If things are going wrong in our life, all we have to do is just let go and let God. Just turn them over to God, give God control of the events of our lives, and our lives will get better. The fact is, very often, we turn things over to God and they get worse. And that can be a jarring experience. We believe that God cares for us, don't we? We believe that God knows what is best. We believe that God can do what is best. So why, when we have turned things over to Him, would they get worse? About 2 months ago, I was getting ready, maybe a bit of background information. I'm a Civil Air Patrol chaplain. The Civil Air Patrol is the civilian auxiliary of the United States Air Force. And among my responsibilities as a chaplain in the Air Force Auxiliary is to conduct worship services for training exercises and other events that are held on Sundays when Civil Air Patrol personnel can't be in their churches because there are things going on. It's important that they be given the opportunity at least to worship. So about 2 months ago, I was asked to conduct a worship service for a training exercise at an airfield to the north of where we live. And I agreed to do that and was looking forward to it. There's a fair amount of administration and management and preparation that goes into this kind of thing, but it's something that I enjoy doing. So I was prepared to be at the airport very early on Sunday morning, and Saturday afternoon, I got a call from a pastor across town. I live near Minneapolis. He ministers in St. Paul, and he explained to me, "Kevin," he said, "I've broken my back, and I need somebody to be in the pulpit tomorrow." He said, "Can you do it?" And I did a quick calculation. I asked him, "What time is your worship service?" He told me when it was, and I thought about the time that my Civil Air Patrol service was going to end and the time that their worship service was going to begin. I reflected that it was Saturday afternoon, and he probably didn't have a long list of other people to call. And what I told him was, "I can be there to preach, but if I come preach, I'm going to have to be in uniform." He said, "That's fine. As long as you show up, our people will be interested to see you in uniform." So we agreed that I would do that and then preach the Sunday evening service. So from the beginning, it looked like it was going to be a very stressful day. When Debbie and I left the driveway that morning, she went with me for all the events of the day. When we left the driveway that morning, we prayed for safety as we traveled. We prayed that the Lord would bless the ministry during the day. And I was asking God for special strength because this was going to be a challenging series of events to try to fit everything together. Well, the first thing that happened, the Lord answered our prayer by helping me not be able to find the place in the airport that we were supposed to go. So here we are. We're wandering around this airfield and trying to figure out, we're over here, we probably need to be over there. And finally, we worked it out. We got there in time, conducted the worship service, traveled to St. Paul, preached wearing my Civil Air Patrol uniform, and then after the service had a brief time of relaxation in the evening before we had to go back to the service. That evening, we were headed for the service. We were within a quarter mile of the church when our vehicle was struck from behind. It was about 20 minutes until service time. I called 911 and reported that we had a vehicle accident. There were no injuries, but there was property damage, vehicle damage. And the dispatcher informed me that all of the St. Paul officers were already assigned to tasks, and she would send somebody as soon as she could, but she had no idea when that might be. It was 20 minutes until the service was supposed to start. at 5 minutes before the service was supposed to start. Now, we were only a quarter mile away. At 5 minutes before the service was supposed to start, I was getting a little nervous. And so I called the church, and somebody picked up the phone, and I said, would you please convey a message to the assistant pastor that, you know, this has happened, I've had a fender bender. We may walk in late to the service. And this person said, sure, I'll convey that message. Well, about 10 minutes later, here came the assistant pastor's wife. And her first suggestion was, why don't you just leave your car and come on down to the church and, you know, be in the service? And I thought, no, the police are not going to look kindly on that. But then she helped us out, and time went past. It was time for the service to begin. The police hadn't come. It was a quarter after. It was 20 after, 25 after. At half past, I knew that I was supposed to be preaching. The police still hadn't come. Here I was. The Lord was working out the details of the day in ways that I hadn't expected and wouldn't have preferred. Have you ever found yourself under those circumstances? Now, this is a real small one, okay? I mean, if a church doesn't get to hear me preach, what have they really lost? No comments. Well, thank you for that. But some of you are facing situations in your lives that you have turned over to God, and you have trusted Him to make those situations better. And instead of getting better, those situations have got worse. You know, that's just the situation in which Habakkuk found himself. He was in the country of Judah, and the country of Judah was in a condition of moral, political, and spiritual decline. And he told God about it. God, you've got to do something. And God's reply was, Habakkuk, I'm about to do something. I'm about to send the Chaldeans. And Habakkuk couldn't believe it. The Chaldeans are worse than the Judeans. What? How can you use somebody who is worse to judge somebody who is not as bad? And so God explained it to him, as we studied this morning, if you were here this morning. But all of this still left Habakkuk with a choice. How was Habakkuk going to respond? What we see in chapter 3 of Habakkuk is Habakkuk processing all that he has been told, the situation that he's in, the things that God has said to him. He is processing the information, and he is coming to the point of decision. Well, I don't know what situation you may be facing this evening, but whatever it is, if you have turned something over to God, and instead of getting better, it's got worse, I would like to bring you to the same point of decision that Habakkuk faced. And I want to do that by leading you through Habakkuk chapter 3. So if you have your Bible open to Habakkuk, okay, if you've forgotten where Habakkuk is, start it at Matthew and just back up a few pages at a time. And by the time you've got about five of those little books, so you've gone back through about five of those little books in the Minor Prophets, you will be at Habakkuk. If you get into Nahum, you've gone too far. Go forward from Nahum, okay? We're in Habakkuk chapter 3. And Habakkuk in chapter 3 is confronted with three truths that bring him to the point of decision. The first truth is in verses 1 and 2. Verse 1 says, a prayer of Habakkuk, the prophet, upon Shigionot. Okay? As you look at that verse, this verse ought to tell you something. The only place that you find verses like this, words like this, are at the beginning of Psalms. You see this kind of thing a lot in the book of Psalms. What this verse is doing is labeling Habakkuk chapter 3 as a psalm. Habakkuk is summarizing his experience in a way that can be sung. Now, of course, in our Bibles, because we have translations rather than the original language, and because we don't know how the Hebrew music worked, we're not able to sing this chapter like they would have in Habakkuk's day. But it's a psalm. It's one of the psalms that's outside the book of Psalms. Anyway, Habakkuk continues and he says, O Lord, I have heard thy speech and was afraid. O Lord, revive thy work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years make known. In wrath, remember mercy. So here's the first truth that Habakkuk confronts, and it is this. Habakkuk realizes that he is still in the middle of the story. Now, I said this morning, God has a plan. God is working out his plan. God's plan goes into operation at creation, and it ends in a new heaven and new earth. This is God's plan, and the Bible is really the story of God putting his plan into action. And we are part of that story. God has written you into his story. You have a place in that story. So did Habakkuk. But what Habakkuk realized is that I am still in the middle of the story. You look at that expression, in the midst of years, or in the middle of years. What does that mean? Well, it means there are years that have gone by, and there are years that are still to come. God has done some things. God is going to do other things. And I'm in the middle right now. Now, Habakkuk lived a long time ago. He lived about 600 years before Jesus did. From our point of view, that's a long, long time. But we are still in the middle of the story. Now, of course, we're a lot closer to the end of the story than Habakkuk was. There's been a lot of the story that's taken place between Habakkuk and us. But we are not at the end of the story yet. There are things that God has done. There are things that God is going to do. There are years behind us, more years than there were for Habakkuk, but there are still years in front of us. And we need to realize that we can't expect God to act in the middle of the story like he's going to act at the end of the story. So what can we expect God to do? Well, Habakkuk says, Lord, revive your work in the midst of years. In between the years that have passed and the years that are coming, he prays, God, revive your work. What does that mean? I know when we think of revival, we have this image in our mind of you know, a guy coming in and preaching a week or 2 weeks of messages. Wait a minute, they don't do that anymore, do they? I can still remember when they used to. And you know, people would come down the aisle, and they used to call it kneeling at the altar. You'd see a lot of people, you know, on their knees at the front of the church building, and then they'd go out and actually live for God for about a week. That's not what Habakkuk is saying. What Habakkuk is saying is, God, I have seen what you have done in the past. I've seen in the writings of Moses how you opened the Red Sea in front of the nation of Israel. I have seen how you worked through Elijah and Elisha, not with my own eyes, but I know you did those things because they're written down. These are truths. God, you have done great works in the past. Now, God, since you can do great works, would you please do them again? Would you please do them again? Do for us what you have done before. Now, of course, because of where we are in the story, we know that there are certain things God doesn't intend to do at the present moment. But having said that, I don't think it's at all out of place for us to ask God to do great and marvelous works like he has done before. Let me just give you one example. Do you believe that the United States of America is utterly lost? I do not. We are living in very dark times. There is a great deal of wickedness in our nation. There is corruption. There is a moral inversion that has taken place. And it may well be that what is taking place right now is a precedent for the decline, the apostasy that is going to take place and run us straight into the tribulation. And of course, if that's what happens, Jesus will rapture us before the tribulation begins. That's what may happen. Or it may happen that things will grow worse and worse, but it's not for the tribulation, and Jesus isn't going to rapture us, and we may have to go through sufferings and persecution such as saints have had to go through in every other generation in most other places in the world. That may happen. But I'll tell you something else that may happen. God may grip the hearts of his people and change us so much that he uses us to transform the society around us. Now, don't get me wrong. That kind of transformation is not going to be permanent because we know sooner or later there's an apostasy coming. But God did it before, and God can do it again. And our responsibility is to wait upon God to act, but in the meanwhile, to be faithful, to be the kind of people he can use. Habakkuk has one other prayer that he utters in this verse. He says, "In wrath, remember mercy." Did the nation of Judah deserve God's wrath? Nod your heads yes, class. They richly deserved God's wrath. Habakkuk could not plead the righteousness of the Judeans. He couldn't claim that they didn't deserve what they were going to get. But what he prayed was, even though we deserve wrath, remember mercy. And I think we can legitimately pray that all the time. We can pray that about our lives. We can pray it about our families. We can pray it about our businesses. We can pray it about our churches. We can pray it about our country. We can pray it about our world. Because God is a God who loves mercy. And we're still in the middle of the story. We know approximately where we are, but we don't know exactly where we are. You know, Daniel 9 talks about 70 heptads, 70 weeks that begin with the restoration of Jerusalem and end with essentially what we would call the tribulation. And he teaches that between the 69th week and the 70th week, there's this gap. And we know that we're somewhere in that gap. What we don't know is how long that gap is supposed to be. Somebody talked to me earlier today and wondered if I was going to say anything about dispensationalism. I just did. Okay? We're in that gap. We don't know how long it's going to be. We hope that we're near the end of the gap, but we don't really know that. So what we can do is to be faithful. We can ask God to work in us and through us, and we can ask God for his mercy upon us and upon those whom we love. This is the first truth that Habakkuk realizes. I am still in the middle of the story. Second truth is in verses 3 through 7. God came from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. And his brightness was as the light. He had horns coming out of his hand, and there was the hiding of his power. Before him went the pestilence, and burning coals went forth at his feet. He stood and measured the earth. He beheld and drove asunder the nations, and the everlasting mountains were scattered. The perpetual hills did bow. His ways are everlasting. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction, and the curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. By the way, and this is just an aside, you'll notice that I didn't read the word Selah, and you may be wondering about that. In fact, you may be wondering, what is that word there for? What does it do? The answer is that we don't know the exact meaning of the word, but we think that it was probably, since it only occurs in the Psalms, we think it was probably some kind of a musical instruction. We've heard some good music this evening, haven't we? Have you enjoyed the music this evening? I particularly enjoy it when your music pastor plays the piano. And he looks at those notes, and he's able to take black spots on paper and turn them into beautiful music. But you know there are things in his music that he doesn't do anything out loud with. There may be a word like adagio or a word like allegro. And he's playing the music. He doesn't read those words to you. In fact, it would be kind of odd if he did, playing along, adagio. Which means it's going to be kind of slow. Or allegro, which means it's going to be kind of fast. Or poco a poco diminuendo, which means it gets slower little by little, which is kind of me at the end of the day. Okay? Those words aren't there to be read aloud. They're instructions. They're things you do. And that's probably how the word Selah functioned. So when we read the text, we may or may not read that word aloud. One way of thinking about it is this. When you see the word Selah, you should pay particular attention to what has just been said and what is about to be said. Think of it like an alteration in the music. There's a speeding up or a slowing down or a shifting of keys. My mind is on cars all of a sudden. I don't know why. A change in the key, something of that sort that would lead you to pay special attention. Treat the word Selah like that. But now, back to the text. What's going on in these verses? Well, I think that what's happening in these verses is that Habakkuk is being confronted with a theophany. Now, if you don't know what a theophany is when God actually shows up visibly and shows himself to people. And I think that's what's happening here in these verses. Beginning in Teman and Mount Paran, which are down toward the south of Judah, you have God coming up toward Habakkuk, revealing his glory. His glory covers the sky. The earth is full of his praise. His brightness is like light. This line in my King James that talks about him having horns coming out of his hands and there was a hiding of his power, think of it this way. Imagine that it's like God is holding this orb, this ball of incredible radiant glory in his hand, and he closes his fingers over this radiant glory and holds it up, but between his fingers, the rays of light are just shooting out, and God is holding his glory in his hands. God is using pestilence. In other words, he's forcing disease to serve him. Burning coals are at his feet. He's forcing conflagration to serve him. He stands, he measures the earth, he looks around, and he begins to manipulate the nations. The idea here is that as God approaches, his splendor is evoking praise. Apparently, he is surrounded by the hosts of heaven. They are praising him. God has power that he hasn't even revealed. His restrained power just is bursting out. He forces even calamities to serve him. Remember that. Remember that when you're enduring calamity. Is there disease coming into your family, maybe even into your body? Is there financial loss looming, or maybe it's already occurred? Is there betrayal or bereavement? God even uses these calamities. They too serve him. And in verse 6, there is nobody and nothing that can withstand him. In fact, according to verse 7, even though they may have forgotten it, God governs the nations. In other words, the truth with which Habakkuk is confronted is this: God is still mighty. That's a word that we don't often use. In fact, the last time I can think of anybody using the word mighty in the secular world is for the old cartoon Mighty Mouse. And that kind of dates me. But God is mighty. He has strength. He has power upon power. God's hand is not weak. God is able to act in the world. He may not act directly, but he can act even through things like diseases and fires. God is at work, and he is at work in all the power of his strength. We believe in what is called the doctrine of providence. What providence means is that in every event of our lives, there are two kinds of causation at work. There is the natural causation. Why do we get a disease? Well, because we're exposed to a pathogen. Why do we endure financial loss? Because somebody made a bad financial decision. But there is also divine causation. God is superintending the events of our lives. God is controlling them, watching over them, working through them, so that nothing ever happens to us outside the will of God. Which means, even in the horrible events of our lives, God is at work. He is doing something. In fact, he's not just doing one thing. He's doing hundreds of things. We can't even begin to imagine everything that God is doing in our lives. And here, Habakkuk is being confronted with a vision of the power of God. It's Joseph talking to his brothers. You remember Joseph? His brothers are terrified. They've come to him and they're effectively begging for mercy. In fact, they're lying to try to get mercy. You remember what Joseph says to them? He says, "You meant it for evil. God meant it for good." It's the same verb going both ways. They meant it, God meant it. They meant it one way, God meant it a different way. There may be evil people at work in your life right now. There may be people who are seeking to destroy your life, and they mean it for evil. But if God has permitted those people to come into your life, God also means it. Only he means it for your good and for his glory. God is always at work, and he is mighty. This is the second truth that Habakkuk confronts. Now we come to the third truth, verses 8 through 15. This is a little convoluted here, but let me read through it and I'll go back and comment on it. Verses 8 through 15. Was the Lord displeased against the rivers? Was thine anger against the rivers? Was thy wrath against the sea, that thou didst ride upon thine horses and thy chariots of salvation? Thy bow was made quite naked according to the oaths of the tribes, even thy word. Thou didst cleave the earth with rivers. The mountains saw thee, and they trembled. The overflowing of the water passed by. The deep uttered his voice and lifted up his hands on high. You're looking at crashing waves here. The sun and moon stood still in their habitation at the light of thine arrows they went. At the shining of thy glittering spear, thou didst march through the land in indignation. Thou didst thresh the heathen in anger. Thou wentest forth for the salvation of thy people, even for salvation with thine anointed. Thou woundest the head of the house of the wicked by discovering the foundation unto the neck. Thou didst strike through with his staves the head of the villages. They came out as a whirlwind to scatter me. Their rejoicing was as to devour the poor secretly. Thou didst walk through the sea with thine horses, through the heap of great waters. Okay, here's what's going on in these verses. There are two things happening in these verses. First, God is coming in wrath and he is judging his enemies. That's verses 8 through 11. Second, God, in overthrowing his enemies, is delivering his people and judging the wicked. That's verses 12 through 15. Now, for interpreters, the challenge is to try to figure out whether Habakkuk is talking about something that God has already done in the past, or whether Habakkuk is having a prophetic vision of something that's going to occur in the future, and because he's seeing it happen, he's describing it as a past event. So is Habakkuk talking about what is past? Is Habakkuk talking about a judgment to come in the future? And my response is, well, years ago, I was living in Dallas, Texas, when the Dallas Cowboys recruited Deion Sanders away from the San Francisco 49ers. Deion Sanders was an outstanding football player. He was also a baseball player. As a football player, he was so good that he could play offense as a receiver, he could play defense as a defender. And I don't remember who it was, produced a television commercial about that time with Deion Sanders walking down the street with the owner of the Dallas Cowboys. And the owner of the Dallas Cowboys says to him, "Deion, what's it going to be, baseball or football?" And Deion says, "Both." And the owner says, "Well, Deion, what's it going to be, offense or defense?" And Deion says, "Both." "Well, Deion, what's it going to be, 15 million, 20 million? And Deion says, "Both." So is this passage talking about something that God has already done, or is it talking about something that God is going to do? My answer is both. Both. I think that what Habakkuk is saying is that the things that God has done in smaller ways in the past, delivering Israel with a mighty hand, God will do in stupendous ways in the future. And the God who once delivered Israel, the God who will marvelously deliver his people in the future, is the same God who cares for you now. The truth that Habakkuk confronts is this: God will deliver his people. So we have three truths. You are still in the middle of the story. God is still mighty, and God will deliver his people. And having realized these truths, Habakkuk is brought to the moment of decision. He has to make up his mind. That's verse 16. "When I heard, my belly trembled. My lips quivered at the voice." He's got to choose. He can't put this off. He's got to decide what he's going to do now that he has looked for better. He's getting worse. He realizes who God is. Rottenness entered into my bones, and I trembled in myself, that I might rest in the day of trouble. When he cometh up unto the people, he will invade them with his troops. You see where Habakkuk is going here? That I might rest, that I might rest, that I might rest. How's that going to happen? How's that going to happen? And the answer is, it happens when you trust God. Not trust God to do what I want. I think we're always willing to trust God to do what I want. The trouble is, he doesn't do that very often. Trusting God means trusting God to do what he wants, what he knows is best. And I think Habakkuk is letting us know that he's making the right decision. So what happens when you make that decision? What happens when things are actually getting worse, but you choose to trust God anyway? Let me read verse 17 for you. And I want you to listen to it. You don't even have to look. You just listen to it. And you tell me as I read the verse whether things are getting better or whether things are still bad or maybe even worse. Okay? Here's Habakkuk. He says, although the fig tree shall not blossom. Is it good or bad that the fig tree doesn't blossom? That's bad. Neither shall fruit be in the vines. We're not going to have a grape harvest this year. Is that good or bad? That's bad, especially bad in Israel. They relied on the grape harvest. The labor of the olive shall fail. Not going to get any olives this year. Good or bad? You're noticing a trend here? And the fields shall yield no food. Good or bad? Bad. The flock shall be cut off from the fold. We're going to lose our sheep. Good or bad? Bad. And there shall be no herd in the stalls. We're losing our cows too. Good or bad? I'll tell you what. Any of you ever been a farmer? If you had a year like this, you'd want to quit. And in fact, you might not even have a choice. You might go bankrupt. This is bad, bad, bad. So how does Habakkuk respond? Verse 18. Yet will I rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. Now, Habakkuk's circumstances haven't changed. His circumstances aren't one bit better. They're still bad. But Habakkuk has found joy in his God. His joy isn't coming from his circumstances. His joy is coming from the one whom he knows is in charge of his circumstances. And the result is, in verse 19, that God himself becomes Habakkuk's strength. The Lord God is my strength, he says, and will make my feet like deer's feet. He will make me to walk upon mine high places. And then he concludes with another musical instruction to the chief singer on my stringed instruments. We ought to have the cellist come up here and play this evening. Habakkuk discovers that God is trustworthy. Even when you turn things over to God and they just get worse. So I asked the pastor's wife, assistant pastor's wife, would you please have your husband call me? And he did. And I said, you've got a cell phone, right? He said, yes. I said, if the police aren't here by 5:30, I will call you back. And you will hold your cell phone in front of the microphone in the pulpit. And I will preach to you from my car. And that's exactly what we did. I've never done anything like that before. I don't intend ever to do anything like that again. I'm sitting here in the front seat with my Bible propped up, preaching my sermon. And would you like to know what text I was preaching that evening? Habakkuk 3. Habakkuk 3. And finally, the police officer came just about the time that I was concluding my sermon. I quickly skipped the poem. After all, I had my 3 points in. And said a closing prayer, and the police came, and we filled out the reports, and it was now about 10 minutes after the church service was supposed to be over. And we were done, and I looked at Debbie, and Debbie looked at me, and I said, well, let's go see if anybody's still there. And we walked into the church building, and everybody was still there, and they were still buzzing about the sermon, and I'm pretty sure that nobody who was there at the service that evening is going to forget the truth of Habakkuk chapter 3. Somehow God knew that for somebody in that crowd, that truth needed to be underlined. And it probably needed to be underlined for me too. God is worthy of your trust. Even when things are going horribly bad, and you think that God isn't responding, God knows. God cares. God is at work. God will direct in the way that is best. Just trust Him. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the message of this chapter. Thank you for the message of this book. We praise you that we serve a trustworthy God. Help us to respond rightly in those moments of stress and distress when we either want to rely simply upon ourselves or we want to blame you for the way things are going. Help us just to trust. And I ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.